All right. This is tape 5, side A. We were talking on our last session about duties that you have. We talked about your teaching, recruiting students. What is the writing process in your lab for journal articles?
It is varied between whether I'm the primary writer of the manuscript or whether somebody in the lab is. And up till now, I've been pretty much the person who's written most of the primary articles. Being the person who's been the primary author, the person who writes the first draft of a manuscript. In part, that's because papers on which the first authors and papers we've had to date have been, with the exception of one by Dan Ebro, have been by people who frame English isn't the first language. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot faster for me to write a first draft and then have them check it out for adherence to the facts. Mm-hmm. Than it is for them to struggle with producing a first draft. Right now, though, I've got a student who's from Korea who's got a really good data set for a first paper on which he's first author. And so he's just written the first draft of that. And I think that's important, that the first author, when possible, should be the person who writes the first draft of the paper. Then it goes to me, and I'll probably take it apart and put it back together again. Mm-hmm. And then it'll get bounced back a couple of times.
And in his particular case, how long do you think that process will be? Just sort of a ballpark figure.
It's already been probably about 2 months since I first asked him to give me a manuscript. Until mm-hmm. then, he gave it to me just last week. And hopefully I'll probably get it back to him later than I ought, but hopefully within about 2 weeks.
Okay.
We haven't yet published often enough to really have it down to anything like as smooth and as efficient a process as I'd like it to be. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to work towards is a system where we'll have, from the outset, I've always had the ideal of, I guess I learned early on that right from the beginning you should be thinking about how the data is going to appear in a paper, that you, although it's nice to, and my tendency has been to sort of poke around in the lab, pure exploration, mm-hmm. it's really good as soon as possible to think in the data of the data you're collecting is, at every datum you collect, should be the final version. Should be as if you collected it as carefully as you would, as if it was going to be the one that was going to be published.
Right.
And you structure papers around figures and so on my desk I've got about 5 different binders, each of which is an assembly of data which are being transformed into figures for about papers in 5 different projects. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to use that as a tool for more efficiently assembling papers.
Right. You described earlier in our earlier sessions the lab management styles of some of the people you've worked under. How would mm-hmm. you describe your own lab management style?
Much more towards a hands-off style than towards detailed. It's been pretty unstructured. I think I tend to like people in the lab who work more independently. I've always felt from early experiences in my lab where I felt that I was being criticized too much, not by the PI in the lab, but by some of the senior postdocs in the lab, that for the most part, scientists are self-critical people. Mm-hmm. And you're not, if you see somebody doing something wrong, it doesn't, once you've alerted them to the fact that they're really not conscious of it, after that, you're not going to say anything to them, probably that they're not already saying to themselves. And it's usually too easy to err on the side of over-criticism. So they'll tend to let people maybe point out something that might have done better, but tend to let them come up with their own fixes. I've found that people who've tended to who've come and to join the lab and stayed in the lab, or done rotations and decided to stay, or undergraduates have stayed in the lab for long terms, have tend to be those people who work best in that sort of environment, tend to be more independent minded people who are self-motivated. And there's probably an element of Darwinian selection that, that goes on. And so I'm not sure that I serve all types of students best, but I think more independent people, I think, do well.
Another duty you have is towards your professional community. What are the services that you give to that community? Things like study sections, editorial boards, are you part of those?
I've done reviewing, but I'm not on any editorial boards. I just probably haven't published enough to be visible enough to be asked. It's been on a couple of study sections, no major or one type study sections, a couple of small grant, a couple of ad hoc, one small grant and a couple of ad hoc panels. That was real education. The first time one of those I was on, it was incredible. Everyone ought to at least be able to observe that process before writing any grant, any major grant at all, or see even videotape of a panel in action would be a really useful thing, because what really brought across to me clearly was how very, very important it was to make the grant reviewer friendly, to structure it so that it was so clear to me, having gone through it, that your only real advocate was going to be the primary reviewer, or possibly the secondary reviewer, but you had to make their job as easy as possible. That how very compressed, how very short a time they had to either make the case for your grant or not, and how it was very important to structure grants so that the strong points were laid out as easily as possible for them to communicate to other people on the panel. I was kind of shocked at how the first time panel I was on was one that was for the National Institutes of Deafness, reviewing a small grants, but anything at all deafness related, which meant we had proposals from engineers, from space scientists, as well as from people doing laboratory biomedical work that I was a little more familiar with. And I was shocked that my vote would count equally with anybody else on the panel interviewing something like that. Most people, of course, probably followed the view of the primary reviewers, but it was interesting to see how much influence they had. So I felt that I've learned a lot more from that process than contributed to it. I felt service to the community, where I think I've done a bit more, is in teaching in summer courses off campus. I was a student on the neurobiology course at the Marine Biology Labs way back in 1987, which was then a 10-week course where it's a one residential faculty member to two students ratio, and in fact it's three residential faculty members over the entire length of the course to two students, so it's a big investment in a small number of students. And I felt like when I was asked later on to be on the faculty, I felt like it was something I really should repay. That was being a student there was one of the best scientific experiences I'd had, one of the most intense scientific experiences, and something that really bolstered my conviction that this is the right life for me. This coming summer, I just got invited to be on the resident faculty again there and accepted. I'm really happy about that. So I do a lecture in a summer course in Drosophila neurobiology also at Cold Spring Harbor most years when it doesn't overlap with the marine biology lab course.
And it's at Woods Hole, right? The marine
biology. The MBL is at Woods Hole, yeah. It's one of my favorite. One of my favorite places is the Woods Hole, in particular the library at Woods Hole. I don't know if I'm already. If the sign getting too old already is thinking of places I'd like to retire.
But right.
That will be one place for an ideal retirement, at least during the summer.
So it has a really good library. Then.
It's got a great library, really old library. So they've got holdings that go way back. Some of our scientific interests in cell biology and century olds go back. I've got a 100-year-old datum that I like showing, and that comes out of some of the early cell biology work that was done there.
All right. How do you negotiate the demands of work and family life? That's very pertinent today, isn't it?
Right. We just got off to a late start because it's an unusual situation. My wife, who's been working full-time for a year now, has just gone away to her first conference. So this morning I was, for the first time, getting in charge of getting both kids on the bus and settled in daycare. It's always a tension. It's never... And it was, I think, one of the transitions in my life I found somewhat difficult was the idea of conflicting demands. Right until most of my time through graduate school, I was either unattached or then living with a woman, not currently my wife, but we didn't have children. Then I was pretty certain that I did want children. But when you're unattached or in a relationship like that, it was somebody else who was also a student, a graduate student of the same program that I was living with then. It was pretty much, there was only one, to be a good student was really the only demand on your life. When you're living with another scientist, even investing enough in a relationship was, when both people are scientists, there's a certain tolerance for the amount of time you're going to spend in the lab. So the answer to how should you live your life was, a lot of it was just be as good a scientist as you could, and things were simple. And if you were blowing off the lab to go sailing, and you know, you knew that a certain amount of that was fine, and but you know, it was much easier to keep. There was enough, it seemed now, I'm not sure it seemed like then, that there was plenty of time to go around.
Right.
That something could be, that you had enough time to do something well. Now my general principle is that if I feel like I've got a handle on things and everything's going pretty well, there's something really important that I've forgotten.
Right.
Or more than one. Uh-huh. So it's always a tension. I think one of the reasons I came to Stony Brook, though, was because it's such a good place to bring up a family, and that's a decision I really haven't regretted. It really has been a good place, and I think I mentioned when I was talking about job searches that was a major consideration, and that I turned down offers at places that might scientifically have been better, or at least perceived as being more scientifically prestigious, in order to come here.
Right.
And I still, most days, don't regret that. I've been lucky, I guess. Maybe I should. There's a story to be told that I haven't told yet, which was how I met my current wife and when we got married. So I'll digress a bit.
Good.
So Karen, we'd met actually when I was an undergraduate but she's American, I'm Irish. I did my undergraduate degree in Dublin. I met her through family right before she was due to spend her third year of college in Dublin studying Anglo-Irish literature. She was an English major. She was at Cornell then. And probably the fact that she was at Cornell probably had some influence on the fact that I spent the following summer at Cornell doing research. Even though we didn't get romantically involved in any way then or for about 10 years afterwards, but maintained contacts to a greater or lesser degree. I was in a relationship with somebody else while I was a graduate student most of the time I was at graduate school. We were living together for a couple of years out of that time. And that eventually, the combination of just needing to move on to a postdoc, but more importantly, the fact that pretty much she didn't want children and I did, and I couldn't see there was one of those non-negotiable insuperable obstacles that a relationship founders on, and that one did. I ended up going by myself to San Diego and found my first in the first 9 months in San Diego was probably the most difficult time of my life. It was the time that I came closest to being severely depressed. Lost my measure of it then was that I lost about 10 pounds, which is unusual. I hadn't all that much weight at the time to lose.
Right.
So, and it was, I'd mentioned, I think, way back that there may be a genetic strain of tending toward depression of running in our family. I don't know how much that contributed, but it could be explained situationally. I remember being found the combination of moving to a new place, which was quite alien, and breakup of relationship. The combination was pretty distressing.
I can imagine.
So, I think Karen, it's around the. I'd moved in September, October, and Karen came out to visit me in the spring, and at that, I think I was aware that, you know, we'd had this sort of probably something more than platonic relationship, but for many years. Mm-hmm. I felt things had been brought to a state that obviously I wasn't meant to be alone, and I needed to see if it would go. So I asked her to stay, and she did.
Mm.
She was at the time, she'd done a master's degree in English literature at Harvard, having graduated from Cornell, and was teaching at Rutgers. But she left that to come out with me, for which I'm extremely grateful then and since. And we were married in the mission in San Diego in
92. Oh.
So we were, I think, yeah, we didn't have any children while we were in San Diego, and we're beginning to get, I think not for want of trying, I think we were beginning to get to the stage of probably a lot of 30-something-year-old couples, about 18 months or so of when you wonder, are you going to have children? We were beginning to wonder if we would. But then Karen got pregnant shortly before we moved to Stony Brook.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had another child since. So
what does she do now?
Karen, now she's worked at, in San Diego, she worked as an environmental consultant. She has an amazing talent for turning to and being expert to whatever she picks up. She'd worked in Stony Brook between children. There was a 3-year separation there. She worked part-time for a local software company that's run by one of the biology professors here. And then from September of last year, she's been working full-time for the university as the director for undergraduate research. So she coordinates a lot of the fellowships and writes grants to get undergrads into research labs.
Right. And you have two children. Can you give us their full names?
Our daughter, who's 7 now, is Ciara Kernan. It's an Irish name, C-I-A-R-A, very common here, but in Long Island you always have to explain to people that it's not Italian and not pronounced Ciara.
Mm-hmm.
My son, who's 4, is Thomas, after my father, Thomas Pierce Kernan. And they're right. And they're on the whole two pretty easy and manageable kids, which doesn't mean that I think in the first years and in the year or two after Thomas was born, when you make this change, the big change from one child to two, those were still stressful in terms of demands on time. Though for a lot of the time Karen wasn't working or was working only part-time, so she did the bulk of the child rearing.
And I mean, how do you divide sort of the mundane tasks now, sort of things like laundry, preparing food? How does that normally go?
Karen does laundry, finances. I'm usually the cook. And we probably divide up the shopping, but I'll do most of it. Karen tends to be the person who does. We just took the big step of going from 1 car to 2 cars, which is having still some environmental conscience I feel bad about, but it was necessary because just picking up everybody else after work was just too much time. So we tend to divide child pick up and drop off, and I was just discovering this morning of that, yeah, Karen probably does most do most of the things in the morning. So she does, you know, making sure they're both dressed and shoes are on the right feet is mostly her.
Right. Okay. What do you do for fun and leisure when you want to decompress?
What I would like to do and what I actually get time to do are two different things. Mostly what I actually find cooking relaxing. So that's, and so if there's something I do every day, it's that, and I still read an awful lot, usually between later than I should at night. So usually between the hours of 11 and sometimes midnight, sometimes 1 p.m.
Right.
Or 1 a.m.
What are you reading now?
Right now, Stephen Carter's novel, The Emperor of Ocean Park, I was reading last night, and a book by Matt Ridley called Mendel's Demon, about sort of selfish gene theory.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, what are we? What, the other thing I liked doing, and one of the nice things about Stony Brook was just what I call pretty much destructive gardening. So most of, one of the nice things about Stony Brook was being able to, when we moved here, property was cheap enough, we could buy a house that was on 0.7 of an acre with some trees on it.
Mm-hmm.
For someone Irish, that's particularly significant because there aren't very many trees in Ireland, not because they can't grow there, but because they were all chopped down a long time ago.
Right.
And the only place you'd find trees was around wealthy houses. Mm-hmm. And with lots of land. So it was sort of something of a status thing, having mature trees on your property.
Right.
Even though at this time of year, what they do, of course, they're all oak and they dump several tons of leaves, which I'm in the middle of raking right now. The whole place has to be raked several times over to clear off everything. But compared to our neighbors, our place looks pretty unkempt.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I like to put it is that we manage our property for maximum biological diversity.
Right. That's a good way to put it.
We don't do much, but I still like wielding an axe and chopping wood and mm-hmm. stuff like that. I find that's relaxing.
If you would describe a typical work day from the time that you get up in the morning to the time that you put your head on a pillow.
Get up, drive in, have a momentary thought that I really should be cycling in, park at a somewhat distant parking lot, walk through the encounters with nature or the shortcut through the woods from the parking lot.
Actually, even that
means quite a bit. And of course, it was people from the ecology and evolution department who showed me the shortcut through the woods, which they all tend to take, being closer to nature. They get in at about somewhere around 9 o'clock, check email. So if I've had a well-planned day, have had waiting for me a list on the rare days, waiting for me a list of the things I ought to be doing, or at least the first things I should be that didn't get done the day before,
mm-hmm.
And try and catch up with that. Good days are days when I actually were get a fair way through the things I intended to do. Bad days are the days where the interruptions start and pile up almost immediately. It'll be what I still find I'm getting faster at, but still find takes a long time, is writing anything. And that could be anything from even responses to emails, response to something that I've actually taken some pride in carefully maintaining relationships with collaborators. And say the letter or email that initiates a collaboration is pretty important. So it'll take too much time over that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I don't yet have the knack of writing naturally. So everything has to be written as gibberish first and then revised.
Mm-hmm.
most days it'll be that sort of writing. Somewhere around mid-morning, I'll try, if I have any fly work going, I'll break away and do that for a while and talk to people in the lab. Mm-hmm. While I'm doing that, or on my way down to the fly bench, grab lunch, eat it in my office. Somewhere in there, there'll be a class to prepare or a upcoming presentation to prepare. I'm not sure that the day is. Thereafter, the day sort of degenerates into either. I find that I can, if I'm doing experimental work or seriously committed to doing experimental work, which is usually either fly work or electrophysiology, that'll get done in the afternoon. I've considered that even since we moved into this nice office, it's probably bad for me because it's a nice place to hang out.
It is.
And it's probably would be better if I had less of an office and came in the lab and put my bags down on the floor first at the lab bench. Mm-hmm. It might be a better way of initiating the day. I tend to be probably too much to be too easily diverted from a plan, so I'm at the victim of whatever email I got last or whatever the last interruption was.
Right.
Serious time management. I'm not sure I'll ever achieve it, but there are a couple of things to do. I've got one of the most important time management and lab management tools is this, which I've just picked up, which is the doorstop,
right.
Which is the keeps open or close the door between the lab and the office. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, I like to have both the lab and the door to the lab and the front door to the office open. And the principle is anyone can come and interrupt me at any time. That's not good for time management, but if you're going to have a hands-off lab management style, that's important.
Right.
That you can be interruptible.
Hmm. And what time do you usually knock off and go home?
Almost always. These days I'm picking up one child or the other, which means a hard deadline of leaving the lab no later than 5:30. Hmm. Then some days I find if there's a upcoming deadline or I have a lot to do or really felt that I didn't get anything at all done, I'll come back into the lab after around 8:30 or so, after having done some of the work, cooked dinner or helped get the kids. Usually if it's 8:30, the kids are not in bed yet, but mm-hmm. I've helped to get them some way towards there.
And then I take it when you return, since you've already mentioned reading, you probably read and mm-hmm. go to bed too late.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Assess, if you would, your efforts so far in achieving your professional goals.
I seem to keep being on the cusp. There's such a thing as an extended cusp of achieving my professional goals. But I would say yes, I have achieved some of them, some of the personal ones, but I feel like I haven't yet paid back the investment that's been made in me. I think we're on the right track to doing it, but we're not there yet, and it may well happen in the next year or two. I feel for the first time we have multiple papers that could be come out in the next year. Mm-hmm. And it really has been over the last year or two, the fact of that now we have gone from being a lab with a collection of mutants, but didn't know which gene we worked on. So in one sense, the answer, when people asked me, what do you work on? The straight answer was, well, I really don't know. Mm-hmm. That is, we had the mutant with a phenotype, but we didn't know what molecule, and we didn't really know what cellular mechanisms we were working on. Now we do, we know we can divide things up into whether they affect. We think they affect transduction or they affect cell differentiation, cellular genesis. We've got handles on molecules, and what I find is that collaborations come much faster when you can, they're much easier to say, I work on triple-A channels or I work on ZP domain proteins, or I work on intraflagellar transport proteins. Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. gives them people a much easier, faster grasp of the sort of thing you work on than saying, well, we've got this mutant and it sort of does this and we really don't know what it's involved in yet. Mm-hmm. And that's, in a way we had to go through that, the earlier stage, and the payoff is coming now. We're finding either novel molecules or familiar molecules but involved in novel mechanisms. Right. The graduate student in the lab who just gave me that manuscript, he's found a new, but I think it's going to be a really nice last section of his thesis that will deal with a completely new phenotype for what was up until now a rather familiar molecule, where our publication would have been just another Me Too story showing that something, we've now shown that the molecule in flies is doing something quite different from, in addition to the things we expect, it's doing quite something quite different from the things that have been already well characterized in other systems. Mm-hmm. So the new and unexpected is always good, mm-hmm. for it, especially when you're a geneticist. And I'm glad for Yanggu that his graduate thesis is going to hopefully be even more interesting than mine was.
And where do you see the lab going and yourself in, say, the next 5 years?
We're going to for the three main areas that we're working on, for transduction, we have to decide whether or not to make a real stab at reconstituting a transducer system. Now, we've got a couple of ion channels, which was the missing ingredient, mm-hmm. That we could try and do this with. That means getting serious about going back to cell culture techniques, deciding which cells to try and express our molecules in, and how to do some real electrophysiology on them. And not only doing standard cell culture techniques, but then doing something different, which is to try and put our candidate extracellular ligand, or Nompei protein, on something that we can mechanically manipulate when it's in contact with cells. Mm-hmm. I've been talking about this as a thought experiment for a long time, but now we've got to put up or shut up. The cell differentiation work is something that I think could be extremely fertile. We'll try to pursue both. The lab right now is a little top-heavy in that we've got two fourth- and fifth-year postdocs who are now actually no longer postdocs. They have fourth-year research scientist appointments. They'll probably be leaving. They'll be gone maybe towards the end of a year from now. Mm-hmm. or within the next 2 years. So I've got to do some recruiting and I've got to do some fundraising to make sure that set of projects go ahead. And the polysystem project, I hope, is going to turn out well. And in general, I think it's important for a lab to throw off enough new and different projects, certainly that the postdocs who've worked on them can take them with them. And that's something I would like to. It was always a source of some tension in the Zirkow lab as to whether postdocs would be or would not be competing with Charles's lab, which is very large, well-funded, Howard Hughes lab, highly mm-hmm. competitive. In my case, somewhat less so than others, because I was working on a new project that was different from what the bulk of the lab was doing at the time. But still, by the time I left, there was another postdoc and a couple of students working on the same project. Since we had done a mutant screen that had thrown up a lot of mutations and as it turned out, thankfully, a lot of different mechanisms, there's plenty of work to go around. Mm-hmm. So it didn't turn out to be an issue. But I still think it's important that postdocs be, towards the end of their career, be given the opportunity to the bulk of the work that they do in the lab. If it's giving rise to a new project, it should be a well-defined, portable project that they can take with them and establish their own lab without fear of having to grow out from under the shade of a mm-hmm. tree. Not that our lab currently casts a terribly big shadow. Mm-hmm. So I hope that we'll continue to throw off new projects and new ideas like that.
Okay. How about in 10 years? Or is that too far down the road?
In general, I would like us to have, I don't know, I construct these imaginative theories as to, you know, that serve as not really even hard experimental hypotheses, but as ways of structuring, you know, structuring ambitions. So I had this, part of the reason we're in polycystin research, these molecules that are involved in kidney disease, was that we thought there was a sort of grand unified theory in which our extracellular protein, ZP domain protein, would be generally the extracellular ligand for polycystins, and we'd have a whole new signaling system here, and we'd sort of put together a table of instances in which this seemed to be the case. It's probably not true in exactly those terms, though there may still be something to it. I could build a spin a story right now as to wouldn't it be great if lines, and which is quite often how I start generating theories.
Right.
Wouldn't it be cool if this happened? My current wouldn't it be cool if was that ion channels have a lot more to do with the cytoskeleton and the regulation of cell division than currently they're given credit for. Ion channels have typically being studied at the periphery of the cell, where most of them are located, and studied in isolation from cytoskeletal structures. If there has been a connection made, it's the effect that the cytoskeleton has had on the ion channel function. Mm-hmm. And ion channels have been studied mostly by people who care about how a cell works when it's mature, whether that's a neuron or another cell. I think there's the potential for connections to be made between ion channels, particularly calcium channel feedback on cell divisions, and with the particular case being the polycystins, which are probably located on cilia, which cilia grow out of basal bodies, and basal bodies are the same thing as centrioles, which go back and organize cell division. When you have a defect in a polycystin, you get at least in kidney cells, you get an over cell proliferation defect, and I think that's really significant. So one big question is to follow that line of reasoning as far as we can.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big issue for us that's connected with that is when do we make or do we make the jump from Drosophila or do we always stay in flies? Flies don't have dividing ciliated cells. Their ciliogenic cells seem to be at the... they're only in cells that are completely differentiated and don't go on and divide. So we're not in the best system for tackling that particular issue. I think we can't do it now, and I'd need to have. It would be we could only do it if we did another cycle of recruitment, and probably if we recruited a real cell biologist. But right in the middle of this integrated center for developmental genetics, in which there are good cell culture people, there are good cell biologists. So we're in the right place and the right to do it if we so choose.
Okay. All right. The next set of questions. Take sort of a different tack. They have more to do with sort of technology, patents, sort of ethical questions as well. Do you have any patents?
No.
Okay, and what is your own view about, are patents good for academic science, in your point of view?
A nice profitable patent would be awfully good for me. And it would be awfully good for Stony Brook, too.
Right.
You know, this is not a rich university, and the patents they do have, there's a couple. They have one or two big patents that have brought in a lot of money and are extraordinarily important for the well-being not of just of the research enterprise, but of the university as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
There's no big endowments. They don't have a big alumni pool, and the alumni they do have are not on the whole rich. So, for this university, the possibility of patent income and which is generated, and there's been so much investment in research here, the possibility of patent income, you really can't say, you can't be too, I wouldn't want to turn down any patents for the sake of the university, and in addition for our own sake. All the same, though, I have this suspicion arising generally from the observation that healthcare costs keep going up. That although the research enterprise in the U.S. generally is seen as a way of, as being a great boon to biomedical care, it could also be viewed as a way, as a very efficient way of making healthcare more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
That it introduces that the whole paradigm of where research leads to drug. First of all, the fact that the endpoint of research is seen as a drug is, and that therefore you have to go through both the pharmaceutical company and the extremely expensive drug testing process, means that you're bringing many, many levels of layers of people, each of whom have high salaries, into a process where that is seems to be the obvious reason why healthcare is getting so expensive. And that that patents by, you know, staking patents on biomedical territory or on extending it to genomic sequences, that's part of, it's making it worse.
Mm-hmm.
So it should not have to be that way, because good information, good biological information, should lead to cheaper medicine. It should be the case, and maybe it will, it just hasn't got there yet, that you should be able to have more efficient treatment, be able to select people, tailor treatment to people better and cheaper. So many of the techniques that have been used, like PCR, DNA array, because they're miniaturized, they're cheap. Once, you know, the only expense is the cost of development. Once you have it developed, they're pretty cheap, and they're probably a lot more expensive than they need to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they're developed under this connection of research to private enterprise. I'm not sure. I don't know nearly enough about the economics of it to theorize that it could be otherwise. But I just have my suspicions that I'm part of a mechanism that both, while it advances our knowledge of medicine, in fact, is a way of making things more expensive.
Right. Question about ideas. Where do your ideas come from?
In the shower, I say, gosh, wouldn't it be cool if? They come from that. They come from, I'm a lumper rather than a splitter. I like to make connections between things. I'd rather find a sort of a scientific conspiracy theorist. I like to imagine probably more broader and far-reaching connections than might exist, and then see what that means. Most of my theories turn out to be wrong. Ideas come from thinking about things in evolutionary terms, going back, say, and asking what was the origin of the, which came first, the cilium or the centriole or the basal body. Did centrioles have an origin as basal bodies of cilia, that is the motility function and the ciliary function came first, before they were co-opted as the mechanism for dividing cells, or did their mitotic function come first and then after co-opted as cilia? And how would we find out that? What experiments would you do that would give you a certain answer? So it's the kind of posing questions to myself that are a little flaky and vague, and trying the tension between that and trying to say, okay, how do we get to, what can we say for sure? How do we get to an answer that we can be really certain about?
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, putting the unknown territory on the map.
Mm-hmm. Okay, another question is about sort of the history of science. Did you take any history of science classes at any point in your education? I know that you read. I mean, you were reading science.
I read a lot. One of the really important books that I read was Horace Judson's book, Eighth Day of Creation. I think I read that as an early undergrad. Was from our local public library in Dublin. Got that out. That's very, very readable and very appealing book.
Mm-hmm.
It's before, and probably one of the major things that converted from the ecology, field biology track into molecular biology and genetics. I don't know why I hadn't mentioned it before. And it definitely gives the aura of this sort of something that I both am susceptible to and skeptical of, the golden age of molecular biology theory. Was it really that there were these people and that only those people could have made this field or with a field have developed at that time, no matter who was doing the science.
Right.
And I don't know the answer to that.
We're near the end of the tape.
Okay.
I don't want